I'd like to call this talk Just Another Word. And it comes from a time over the winter that I was at Auroville, this spiritual community in South India, just arrived. And then coming blasting through the jungle were songs from my high school days, really like so loud that the hut was sort of pulsating. And this happened most days for a couple of hours in the jungle. And they were mostly songs that I knew from when I was a teenager. So that was interesting. But then there was this one song that I'd never heard before, and I'm kind of glad that I didn't hear it as a teenager. The main line that stays with me is L-O-V-E, is just another word I never learned to pronounce. So that's the title. And this talk was going to be trying to think of other words for love for people that don't connect with the word love, since it's just a word we don't need to learn to pronounce. But I didn't really come up with much, actually. The main thing that I thought would be interesting to clarify is that many times we talk about love and we say we don't mean emotional love, we don't mean just interpersonal love. And then people say, yeah, metta, you mean metta, or maitri in Sanskrit. And I kind of cringe inside. I kind of feel like, no, not quite. That's not quite what we mean. Metta or maitri is literally like friend or friendliness. And that's one of the ways to this deeper love that doesn't need to be called love. And even though for many of us, practicing metta is something that we need to do because of the culture we grew up in, that was not friendly towards our inner being and our inner child and our inner wisdom. I remember it was after living for 20 years and finally going to India for 6 or 7 months that I finally learned something about friendliness, really. Let's say just being able to hang out with life. I was a good student of our culture. The Dalai Lama, a long time ago, went to teach at a meditation center in the northeastern United States, and he was kind of blown away by how much our culture has kept us from learning to be friendly. He said, wow, we're like a bunch of hungry ghosts in this room. Tiny little mouths and big old stomachs. Never feeling enough. And so the practice, like trying to practice metta on purpose, to start to let the mind then remember metta, is an important thing to do. We could do it all day for months and it still might not be enough. We could keep doing it and it would be fruitful. But also to have in mind the limitations of that. That's just one way into this deeper, big love. And so just to get a sense of how big the big love is that we're talking about and calling love, if we remember that metta is one of the four Brahmavihara, one of the four limitless resting places, one of the four places that always can keep expanding more and give more rest. And it's still not, even that is not the big love. So some of the tricks with practicing metta, friendliness, true friendship, we could say, maitri, is that at first, when we start to feel, if we start to feel like, ah, this is metta, this is what they mean, and we feel a flow in and through and from the heart, it's really good to really go with that and kind of become a metta drunkard. Let it take you for hours. But when that shifts and you don't have access to that quality anymore, not to think that you've lost your friendship with life. There can be a shift where it starts to feel more dry because there's not the same sense of flow in the chest. There might start to be more of a sense of seeing a wider perspective all the time more clearly as part of the friendship as it deepens. And one fun thing to play with metta practice, and again, for me, I think it's probably what saved me from the beginning and through the middle and to the end. So I'm not saying don't practice metta, I'm saying do. So watch out for some of these things, that we don't think we have to look friendly to be practicing metta. One thing to play with is to practice offering metta from your part towards someone who's not anybody, who's really not a somebody, to offer metta to that person. Someone in your life that you met that you really feel is not totally graspable as a person. And if you send metta to that person, it can give you a sense of jumping from not just this huge expanse of restful, endless room of friendliness, but something even bigger, even more limitless, even less interpersonal.
What do you mean by somebody not graspable as a person?
I am pretty sure you have met some people in your life that you could see that they don't need to be somebody, and they're not trying to be somebody. They're not quite a somebody. And the sense of offering yourself, offering metta to that nobody, that person, is so instructive, I find.
You mean somebody who doesn't need to be somebody?
Yes. Thank you. Somebody who doesn't need to be somebody. Annetta is helping me say it right. When I was thinking about how in the beginning of my kind of conscious spiritual practice, I landed in Buddhism because that's what was being offered at that time. If there had been another, like a not Buddhist studies, but some other studies program in India, I would have probably gone to that too. But it was Buddhist studies that I could go to and went to in Bodh Gaya when I was 20. And the question that I kept having was, where is the love? Where is the love? Observing the breath, the intention to lift the foot, to move the foot, to drop the foot, to place the foot, etc. Where is the love? At that time, in that arena, it was not a question that I was encouraged to ask. And the answer was practice metta. That was the answer that was given. But it was not a satisfying answer, although I loved the metta practice. And so, slowly, I had to kind of crawl out of the closet of being someone who loves love and the word love and likes to pronounce the word L-O-V-E. But in case you're in a different kind of closet and you don't know how to pronounce L-O-V-E, just that you don't feel in any way unworthy or whatever, because we're saying it all the time here, the way that I did then when no one else was saying the word love and where is it. I remember reading some traditional teachings that talked about past lives. And so we don't have to believe in past lives, but let me just tell the teaching and then we can apply it without the past life part if you like. That it seems that there's a point of view in some teachings from some wise people that what we were kind of worst, our worst qualities in our past lives. So, for example, I must have been very, very violent for a long time. Probably. It's not that I remember my past lives and I'm telling you about it, but I must be, because I love love so much that I would have had to go through a lot of expression of violence to really come to love love that much, to specialize in love so much. So if we don't believe in past lives, we could still acknowledge that when we were born and when any child sort of comes in, there is a kind of predisposition already there towards, to be sensitive towards a certain area So, for example, when I was small, I was especially sensitive about hearing any kind of news story about violence against children or women. So probably I was terribly violent to women and children along, if I have any past lives. But that's why I don't remember them. So we have these pre-existing soft spots or tender spots or sensitivities. And when we just feel them as sensitive, then we'll tend to close around them and easily do harm from there, not realizing how harmful we're being, how powerful, how powerfully we're being moved from that contracted place. And being in a loving atmosphere is one way that can help us allow the sensitivity to be present in a different way. So I want to give a couple more examples. This is not just, I'm not just talking about one thing here. It's not like a one-to-one correspondence that I'm pointing out. Another small example from my life is, if you've known me for more than 3 years, if you've known me before Gyan was born, you know that I was the queen of resting. And I never had time to do anything but retreats, and getting to a retreat, getting back from a retreat, and taking care of whatever had to be done for the retreats. And that's about it, because I had to rest in every other moment. And I'm very grateful to myself that that happened that way. So grateful to that. And now, one friend was laughing the other day when I said, oh, today is a great day. I got to rest for half an hour before lunch. And now Gyan is asleep, and maybe I get to rest again for another half an hour. I used to be someone who rested from like 4 o'clock in the morning until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, if I could, every day. And then maybe some more. Yes?
Is rest a euphemism for anything else, like meditation or just rest?
Oh, I don't consider it so different in my experience. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So not a euphemism, okay. But I just forgot to say, yeah, of course. Okay. I would rest and meditation would come to visit.
Okay.
Sometimes. Yeah. Thank you. So that's part of what I mean. It's kind of like an arrow that's drawn back in one direction and then it can really go flying the other way. And so another small example of the soft spot, that kind of extra sensitivity that we each have in some way or ways, that we can tend to close around, and it can seem like we are, we have no love, or we have no stillness or rest, or we have no activity in us. And then as that starts to open, we go flying towards activity or love or whatever. But just to start with some examples that we can really work with, if we think of our tender spots, so we could call it a sweet spot also, a place that life can get in. So I remember when we have encouraged people on retreats to not just rest, relax, meditate, do walking meditation, practice patience while waiting in line for the food, etc., but also talked about really feeling what brings joy and bringing that into your day as a practice. Someone at the end of a retreat in Canada talking about his guitar in his closet. That he loves to play guitar. And so the singing that we did each night on that retreat was a revelation and a remembering. And that's what he wanted to offer to the Sangha. Let's meet every week and sing together. But his guitar was in his closet. He was talking about how he didn't ever quite dare to open the closet. And if we could feel how that happens, that there's something that we have a soft spot for, that we feel drawn towards, but we don't open the door. So we have our sensitivities that are maybe a little bit more superficial, such as sensitive in the morning, I like to have my tea at such and such a time in this way, and depending on which country you go to, it gets scary. I wouldn't want to make tea for anyone in England. Unless they measured the water and the tea and the sugar and the milk and the temperature and everything. So they're the kind of soft spots in the sense of what we love that are that kind of make us feel safe by doing them. It's a little, we could say, like control, areas of control. But sometimes we do need those to bring stability. And then we have the soft spots that are kind of a little bit destabilizing, the guitar in the closet or whatever, that maybe go a little deeper into us. It doesn't mean that if I would play the guitar instead of have my tea, I would have less ego. Because once I start to actually open the door and get out the guitar and play the guitar, I could easily have fantasies about being a famous guitarist and, yeah, all of that stuff. But we could stay with that kind of cute hesitation about opening the door, getting out the guitar, like staying innocent with it, but opening the door. So innocent but brave, and get the guitar out. Which way do you? I don't know. And so staying tender with what is tender instead of finding our sensitive spots and then trying to armor them more. Like, it wouldn't be about trying to be a good guitarist. It would be about being a sensitive or tender or a guitarist who still doesn't know what he or she is doing after 20 years. This is not as easy as it sounds. Krishnamurti talks about going from innocence to innocence. He said, "This meditation cannot be learned from another. You must begin without knowing anything about it and move from innocence to innocence." So part of it would be accepting that guitar playing for someone, especially if it's in your closet and you don't quite dare to open the door, you always have a long list of things you have to do first. That would be a serious spiritual practice, to accept that. And then to do it without being serious. To do it, to go from innocence to innocence. What's beautiful when we know that we don't know, but we let that way that life can reach into us in those tender spots and pull us along, is that even when we try not to know, when we try to be innocent, we do have certain ideas about where we're going. We have some memory of when we did play the guitar or when someone else did. And that image may be in front of us to help us open the door and take out the thing, take out the guitar. If we can stay with the innocence that's pulling us and not any kind of should, that I should play the guitar, it should be my serious practice, it will get me somewhere. But the not knowing pulled by the heartstrings. That even that image that was there, that I tried to let go of, I tried to be innocent, but there was still that image about guitar playing as a spiritual practice or whatever. And that at least got me to get out the guitar and start playing. Then if I just keep playing innocently, that image will fall apart. Chögyam Trungpa talks about the teacher as being someone who is willing to keep leading us into the desert of egolessness, like a mirage. And so these images that might be there about how I will play the guitar as my spiritual practice and I'll go into samadhi, what will happen to my fingers? Will they keep moving? Will they get frozen? What will happen? Those images are just like a mirage that keeps us walking into what otherwise looks like a complete desert. But it's not really a trick. It's not really being cheated. Because it's where something in us deeply wanted to go. And we just had to let the mind have something so that it would go along with that. So on one hand, not to be too worried about if we know that we have an image in the mind and we can't quite let go of it. Somehow there's an image, there's an expectation of when I go to meditate, what's going to happen, how it should feel, etc. So being willing to just let that be there, not taking it too seriously, letting it do its work of letting the mind come along for the ride. But also when we come to meditation and that we've come close enough to the mirage to see that it doesn't exist, to say hallelujah. To be so glad to let go of that truth that worked for a while and make room for a new, deeper one. So I was saying that loving kindness is what it's usually called. We could just say love or friendship, metta, is one of the ways, one of the kind of arrows that we could ride into the big love. And in the Buddhist traditional teachings, they talk about the far enemy and the near enemy of each of these Brahmaviharas, including metta. And it makes me laugh a little bit in the context of this talk. The far enemy is hatred. So that's kind of telling you where we've come from. We've come from hatred. And then the near enemy is desire. And then there's the friendship. So desire is that kind of tender spot in us that we could feel as that's my weakness, we say. I have a weakness for chai in the morning. I have a weakness for swimming in the lake. I have a weakness for playing the guitar. And choose the one that you don't tend to do, the one that's more destabilizing, more shaky, as your main practice. And it's scary and lovely to think about desire as what they call in Buddhist teachings the near enemy of friendship. That when there is a really good friend in front of us, the tendency to want to possess that, for it to be only mine. Even if we try to be in our innocence somewhere, the childish part comes and wants it all for myself, like a parent. And so the second Brahmavihara, compassion, karuna, which I think is something that, I don't know if I've ever heard people speak clearly about this, karuna. But maybe we could understand it if we feel into the far enemy is cruelty. So those times or those areas in our lives that we tend to find cruelty happening in the mind. Like really leaning into those places, we might find a movement towards genuine compassion. And I think it's easy to feel the near enemy of compassion, which is pity. How it's so much more comfortable, again, to objectify what we're seeing or experiencing in ourselves or someone else as something separate, where we can just feel pity. I think it's most useful to understand compassion inside ourselves first. I don't think that we have access to what it really means, like with other people. When we feel that we're being compassionate or feeling compassionate, I really have a hard time believing us. I think it's mostly cruelty and pity. It may be because we feel so not allowed to acknowledge cruelty happening in the mind, and so the mind gets very adept, very skillful at subtle cruelty. But if we could recognize cruelty in ourselves, towards ourselves, towards another person, but in ourselves, and kind of really lean back into it to feel what it feels like, to feel that end of the energy, that side of the energy, the same energy that will move towards compassion naturally when it has the space and the love around. So the third Brahmavihara is joy. The far enemy is envy. And I think we would relate a lot to competitiveness and comparing mind. But it's said to be envy, but it's all of those things. And if we could lean back into those in ourselves and try to feel, is there any way that actually, I really feel the envy or the comparing or competitive tendencies, it may allow it, the arrow to naturally move towards real joy, which again, it's hard to know. Do we really know what joy? Do we really know joy? The near enemy of joy is exuberance or excitement, you could say. We know excitement. We experience joy every day. I'm pretty sure that we do. I don't think we would be alive if that weren't bubbling up in us. But maybe it's one of those things that feels like a dangerous drug that we're not allowed to take. But it isn't. It's our lifeblood. Real joy, that's just an uprising, it is revolutionary. And I would like to tell that story of the Buddha's life that I like to tell, so that we could really apply it in a fine-tuned way to our experience. I'm going to tell the really mini version, where he'd done everything cruel to himself that he could. He'd competed with the best and won all of the best yogis of his time. He'd outdone them. They all asked him to lead their ashram. Please take over my students. And he said, no, this is not enough. Tried to find another teacher. He kept outdoing them. The practices were basically like kind of hatred towards the body, cruelty towards the body. We could even say competing against the body. Luckily, something in him realized that this is not really working. Something was still alive enough to say, wait a second. Even if we're winning this game, we don't like the prize. And in that pause, the memory from childhood, so the innocence coming back. So giving a pause when we can see that we're in one of these negative contracting. So instead of the boundless resting places or the ever expanding, we're in the ever contracting hells, hatred, cruelty, envy. And we can feel that it's just contracting and contracting. To just give a pause and see that innocence comes. And then to feel the difference between the true innocence, which in Buddha's case was remembering as a child under a tree, being at peace, feeling joy and pleasure in the body for no reason, and recognizing that this is not that illegal, dangerous drug that will be the end of me. This will be the beginning of me. Recognizing that even the Buddha, after doing all of those practices, after beating everyone at the game and nearly losing his life for it, even the Buddha was afraid of that joy. And it's good to check. Is this really the innocence that's bringing, allowing joy as a way in through my tender spot? Or is this excitement about another idea that I could beat everyone at? And there comes a time where we really need to be and can be immaculate in feeling the difference between the innocence that allows joy to open us and work on us, in us. And the competing or the game or whatever, the ever contracting hell. So there comes a time where we've let the mirage, you know the word mirage in the desert? When it looks like there's water, but there isn't. It's just more hot than over here. So we let the mirage lead us, lead us, lead us. Or it seems like, to the mind's point of view, that we're going towards the water, but it's a mirage. We're going towards the water, but it's a mirage. Some idea that lets the mind give us permission to walk our path. Some idea of love, some idea of knowledge, some idea of meditation. And then there comes a time that we need to know the difference between a mirage and water. We can feel it, and we need to just really be immaculate there. We can be, and we need to be. At that point, the fourth Brahmavihara equanimity, the poor forgotten cousin, does help. There's a kind of way of just be still and know what is the innocence.
What is equanimity?
Let's talk about what is equanimity. The far enemy is restlessness, agitation, etc. The near enemy is indifference, which is what we usually practice when we try to practice equanimity. We try to make it not matter. We try to sit on the mind, try to put big rocks on top of everything so that we can feel proud of how still we are, how still the mind is. Sorry? Restlessness and agitation, etc. We could just call it various forms of agitation. That's the near enemy. You said far enemy, I think, that you were asking? Yeah. So if we would really lean back into agitation and restlessness and let it be and feel it as a tender spot, then we could fly right past the indifference stage. Into the equanimity, into the stillness that allows us to know.
What do you mean, is it tender spot but not fighting?
Yeah. To feel how it's painful, but it doesn't need to be suffering. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need to be my idea of restlessness and agitation, and therefore it's a problem and an insult to me. But the actual experience of it is raw. There's clearly, I'm not in control. There's clearly not a good ego in charge here. And so that could be the direct line. Instead of controlling for a while and then giving up the control, we could just go from really feeling what's moving us that's beyond us, even if it's the old habit energies, etc. If we really feel them as a tender spot and we feel them tenderly, we're going to fly past the temptation to control, and to the temptation in indifference of trying not to feel, toughening the skin, and staying with that very fine sensitivity, which is nearly unbearable, can be very painful, and we will arrive and keep arriving in this ever-expanding experience of equanimity. Equanimity is when anything could happen and I still know the place inside that's not moved. Anything could happen. There could be positive words, negative words, pain in the body, pleasure in the body, pain in the mind, pleasure in the mind. And I can feel how good, like good clear water is the place that's untouched. The place that it's not uncaring. It's not unconnected from the pain and pleasure. It receives those. It allows those to be alive. But it doesn't then want to close down and then let's make a decision here. We've got to do something and strategize. It just stays with the clear stream of aliveness. So it allows there to be joy even in very difficult undertakings or situations. So there's not a, for example, there's not a, compulsion to act or close down in any particular circumstance. The need to act or the need to be still are not needs, like they're tools. There could be action, there could be stillness, but they're not overriding the wisdom, which is actually a definition of samadhi, so that then that's where we go from the ever-expanding world of equanimity right into deep meditation. I can't quite see you. Are you?
I can't either because I don't have my
glasses. No, it's okay. I just mean to know if you have another question.
I don't know if it's related, but when you said to give metta to somebody who doesn't need to be somebody, is that someone you know, or you just mean someone who's not somebody to you?
Oh, no, I mean someone who you experience as not needing anything from you, for example.
Okay.
In a wise way, not just like because they're the bus driver and you already paid, they don't need anything else from you, you know?
Yes, okay.
Shall we? Yes, ma'am.
Is samadhi really compassion or really metta possibly without equanimity?
It's a good foundation. It shows up in all the lists in the Buddhist library. It's one of the factors of awakening. Yeah.
What did you mean when you said to stay in Russia when we see the mirage?
When we see the mirage. Once we've let the mirage lead us right into the heart of the desert of egolessness, then something in us knows we don't need any more mirages and we're tired of that game. And something in us can then feel a kind of clear stream. I would just say what it comes to my mind these months is like a clear stream of sincerity. A clear stream of, even if I don't know what's true, how I long to know that. And maybe a tiny bit, like a tiny bit of what's trustworthy in that stream. So that even if, let's say, outer events are happening, that it looks like everything's going wrong and I must have made a mistake, I have to go back to the beginning and start my whole practice over. And even if we're willing to do that, wait, stop, just check. If you just stay with that stream of sincerity, are we sure that we've gone wrong? Or is it just so helpful that big mirage, like of the beach or something, you know, not just a little pool of water, but that we should be over there. If we stay with this, we know this is the water that we need. So no matter what happens outside, then it's kind of, we can't be taken off our unique path. No matter, someone may be having, let's say, amazing experiences over there, and I should have started out with something else, not meditation, the circus, or whatever. Or, oh my God, you know, I seem to be falling apart, and nobody likes me, or whatever negative thing. But if we just check, no, the stream is still true. And I connect to that, let's say, with my sincerity. And that's all I can do, because it looks horrible or better over there. Or...
Diane?
Yes, sir.
A while ago you were talking about the negativity and being in negativity and how bringing innocence in could you just say a little bit more about that, or how did you bring the innocence into the negativity? Just, I mean, you know, maybe not knowing, or just somehow it's happened innocently, or...
Okay. So yeah, innocence literally would be like not knowing. So if we go back into hatred, cruelty, comparing mind, and agitation, because they can all come at the same time. It's not like they come one by one with it by appointment. But so we go back. Here we are. It would be easy if they all come to say, "Oh my God, I have no idea what's happening. This hurts," and just feel that it hurts. But it would also be really easy to say, "Oh my God, I've really lost it. I never will be free. This is hatred and da 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 da. And I'm such a bad person. Something's really wrong with me. I'll never get over it. I'm getting worse." And then we're going to need maybe someone to rescue us. So the desire for the what we love, the person that we love or whatever, and then the competitive with the other people who might want that same thing, and then cruelty towards ourselves, towards other people to get there. I remember when, at a certain point, a bunch of people, like hundreds of people, dozens and then hundreds of people, started suddenly coming to Lucknow to see Papaji. And before that, we had just been like 10, 20 people, and it was very friendly, a lot of metta, a lot of karuna, a lot of equanimity, a lot of joy. Then suddenly the hordes came. And the hordes came from somewhere that they had a lot of experience with trying to get to the object of your love, so their guru. And literally with the elbows, pushing people out of the way to get the front seat. But this is what happens. And so eventually we got tired of saying, "Oh, look how they're pushing everyone out of the way to get the front seat." One of my friends said, "Oh, it's like every day afterwards we talk about how horrible it is and how horrible they are. It's like we're just smearing shit all over our body. Let's leave the shit in the toilet." So innocence with when it's painful is letting it be that it hurts. It's not that it doesn't hurt to feel cruelty towards myself or another person. Right? It hurts. But if I don't take it as something wrong, like in the idea level, this is something going wrong, this is something I've done wrong or that they did wrong to me or whatever, but it hurts. That's where we need some discernment, is to let it hurt as it does, not making it worse so that we could feel it, but just feeling that it hurts. That's the tender spot, and that allows innocence in, and a response can come. It's like what we talked about the other day with the forest, and just go in there. So I have several poems, and this one poem feels like for Lenny now. It's from T.S. Eliot. Ah, no, not that one. This one. "You say I am repeating something I've said before." This is also T.S. Eliot. "I shall say it again. Shall I say it again? In order to arrive there, to arrive where you are, to get from where you are not, you must go by the way wherein there is no ecstasy. In order to arrive at what you do not know, you must go by a way which is the way of ignorance. In order to possess what you do not possess, you must go by the way of dispossession. In order to arrive at what you are not, you must go by the way in which you are not. And what you do not know is the only thing you know. And what you own is what you do not own. And where you are is where you are not." Meditation, this is Krishnamurti, is one of the most extraordinary things. And if you do not know what it is, you are like a blind person in a world of bright colors, shadows, and morning light. It is not an intellectual affair. But when the heart enters into the mind has quite a different quality. It is really then limitless, not only in its capacity to think, to act efficiently, but also in its sense of living in a vast space where you are part of everything. Don't you want to just hug him? Meditation is the movement of love. This is still Krishnamurti. He does go on a long time. But okay, we can accept. It isn't the love of the one or the many. It is like water that anyone can drink out of any jar, whether golden or earthen, whether golden or earthenware. It is inexhaustible, and a peculiar thing takes place which no drug or self-hypnosis can bring about. It is as though the mind enters itself, beginning at the surface and penetrating ever more deeply, until depth and height have lost their meaning, and every form of measurement ceases. In this state, he goes on, there is complete peace, not contentment which has come about through gratification, but a peace that has order, beauty, and intensity. He goes on. Each one is like a chapter. It can all be destroyed as you can destroy a flower, and yet, because of its very vulnerability, it is indestructible. The vulnerability makes it indestructible. This meditation cannot be learned from another. You must begin without knowing anything about it and move from innocence to innocence. It was strange to me that when I was reflecting on what could be other words other than love to talk about this big love, where meditation leads, I was expecting something that would have a less warm feeling tone, because love tends to have this very warm, high feeling tone. But the word that came and the kind of area of exploration that came to my mind was prayer, which is another kind of taboo word in a lot of meditation circles, especially when Westerners try to find the so-called essence of the teachings and we try to take away all the ritual and devotional practices and so on. We would often leave out something like prayer. But actually, the way that I would like to describe prayer is what we've already said about this connecting to that kind of trickle, that stream. Even if what it is what I don't know is what I know. But this is where I can stay and get water. This is the water. And I connect to that through my sincerity. It kind of invites a space that is spacious. It's not contracting. So even if we feel or felt small and we practice something that we could call a state of prayer, we let ourselves be receptive. So this is still that the vulnerability and the painfulness of difficult states of negativity or whatever, the vulnerability that is actually helping bring the innocence that stays vulnerable, and that very vulnerability is what makes it in the long term indestructible. So the vulnerability widens into receptivity. And there can be a feeling of being not alone, even if we're not praying to something or someone. I think we could easily, depending on our background, we could easily dismiss the idea of prayer, or we could think that it's too tricky because if I'm praying there, I must be praying to something else or someone else. But then, on the other hand, if we think that meditation is something that we only do alone, that's equally tricky and equally inaccurate. And so maybe a state of prayer is a good companion to a state of meditation as ways to slide into the big love. So this state where there's receptivity and a kind of vulnerability that widens into being receptive, whether sometimes out of desperation, I just need help, I don't care where it comes from. That could be a way that we start practicing prayer. And we could maybe not dismiss that as from some kind of arrogance about being meditators and not needing help from outside. We could maybe let ourselves be that desperate sometimes and see what happens. But it could be through joy, it could be through just softening, trusting the innocence, letting it widen. And not only sort of widen out into what we know as a meditative space, but also widen forward and backward. It's lovely in the traditional practices of the Brahma Vihara that they specifically talk about radiating metta, karuna, mudita is the joy, and upekka, which is the equanimity, especially radiating it in each direction, forward, behind, one at a time, to the one side, to the other side, above, below. So if we could let that softening and widening being included and including not only be like in what we know as meditation, but also allowing space for what we might have assumed was not me before. Maybe we're opening to something that is us, but just doesn't identify with the body so much as we do, as the mind does. From our vaster self. Or another really beautiful story. I just love this story about Mother Teresa. Forgive me if I've told it to you before. Or maybe you love the story too, and then it's fun to tell it together again. A journalist asked Mother Teresa about prayer. What do you do when you pray? And she said, I listen. And the journalist got really excited because he was about to get the inner story of what God says to Mother Teresa. What does God say to you? With the pen ready. And she said, God also listens. If we really feel into what is it when I listen? And what would it be to listen together, even if it's not another person or another being, but to listen together, even maybe with my higher self, maybe just with the world, listening together. Mm-hmm. What if we take that out of the closet and play it? There is one more poem. I may as well read it. Also T.S. Eliot. He probably liked his tea. So if you're from England, forgive me for my comment about the tea. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope. For hope would be hope of the wrong thing. Wait without love, for love would be love for the wrong thing. Wait without thought, for you are not yet ready for thought. There is yet faith that could be this sincerity and the little stream of water in us. There is yet faith, but the faith and the hope and the love are all in the waiting. So in the darkness shall be the light, and in the stillness, the dancing. May all beings be free. May all beings be free. May all beings be free. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here.